Welcome, Legionaries, to episode 46 of Legion Cast, Hobby Roundtable. I am your host, Warwick, and joining me this week are my co-host, Paul.
Back for another one, guys. Good to see you.
And my brother, Maniple.
Greetings, Longbeards. Good to be back again. This month's grudge is going to be against bad weather and tornadoes. If you haven't dug your secret bunker to remain safe, start delving today. Don't let the wind win.
Indeed, and as far as my hobby update this week goes, I am just still digging out Beastmen left and right. I'm finding a ton of Minotaur models just in my, you know, up on the rack in my closet, and just stuff that I've had squirreled away for a couple of years now. Getting that ready for Old World, and like Maniple said, I've been dodging tornadoes here in Iowa, so been a little busy for me. Paul, what have you been up to?
Yeah, I've just been working on vampire counts and just kind of getting the rest of the Sons of Horus put together. I wasn't really super keen on Old World, but everyone kind of sold me on it, so we'll see how that goes.
Maniple, what about you?
Yeah, I was digging, as I'm setting up my new game room, I think I found a box of old metal Pestigors. Are those still a thing?
No, but I think you can just run them as, like, sickly Pestigors. I remember that box set that you have. I've seen that at your place, but those are neat old models.
Yeah, I'll try and get them your way. I think I sent some Skaven to Brandon. AP, what'd you say you're working on?
I'm going to do vampires.
All right, I might have some models to send your way as well. Do you like those old school vampire mounted counts?
Yeah.
Horseback? Yeah, I might have one or two of those.
Yeah, could use them.
And this end, I should probably still get that Old World book, but we're starting up a 40K league here in my local area, and I'm painting up some Space Wolves. Interestingly, I'm going to try to paint some of those models so they can be used in 30K and 40K. So I could start that. I think I might as well take the plunge and make that my Loyalist army. Do some Space Wolves, and the color scheme is pretty dang similar. So I think I could run it in either game, no trouble.
Very cool. I like the sound of that. I had fun playing. The one game I played against Space Wolves, I had a lot of fun, so I hope you have fun with them too. That being said, I think that kind of segues us nicely into our Fulgrim's Quest this week, where we are talking about starting a new project. And like, I've only got a couple of things to say on... Basically, what I'll do when I go to start a project is I will pick the faction I want, research it to the bare minimum, you know, learn the names, basically, and then I will buy all the stuff I think looks cool, which is usually a huge effing mistake because some of the coolest models sometimes don't do very well. I love my Contikar Terminators. They're not the best, and they're expensive. So, that being said, where do you guys start when it comes to starting a new project?
Well, I think the first place I've gone to in recent years is just go to the internet, and it's usually a mistake. You say you pick out the ones that are you think look cool and they don't work out. I go and find someone's army list that seems to be doing well and try to buy some stuff off that. But that really goes to that particular player's play style. And since my play style is often different, I don't work it very well, or I don't put it together the way that I think it ought to work, or it doesn't work the way I think it ought to. And so I think for me, what I've tried to do is start small, just run with a HQ and some troop choices, play a game, and then figure out what you want from there. Certainly for me, I always do better if I've got a game coming up. So this 40K league we're starting is going to have, it's going to use the Crusade rules. We're going to start small, paint a unit, play a game, keep building our way up. And I can, if I know I have a game coming up, I will work like lightning and get all kinds of stuff done. But if I know, like, Warwick, you're not going to be here for 2 months, it's like, well, I could work in those Alpha Legion, but I've got other stuff to do. So starting the project, I've got to have the motivation of a game behind it. Then I'll just go to my shelf, pull something off, and get started.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely know Warwick's pain of just being like, getting super hyped about a project or a certain model and going into it. And then, you know, like $1,000 later in 6 months, you realize that you don't actually like the army. One bit of advice I got a little while back from a store owner that really helped me a lot was, I think it was, I went in and they had the Christmas Tau Battle Box. And I was like, you know, Tau have always interested me. I really like the battle suits. And I got $170. I might as well buy this and give him a try. And the guy kind of looks at me. He knew me. He knew I had like 20 armies at the time. And he's like, look, here's the deal, man. Do you actually want to play Tau, or are you just hyped about Tau? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he pulls the Cold Star suit off and he's like, here's this, $50, one character, make it a weekend project. If you come back on Monday and you still are really hyped about this and you really like it, this box ain't going anywhere and you can buy the big box and start the army. But just try the character first. And I went home, spent a weekend on it, really painted this thing to the nines, and I was like, that was a lot of fun. And I realized that I don't want to paint an entire army of this. And so I went back and I was like, yeah, you're right. I didn't want the box. And he's like, yeah, I know.
So that's a great point, Paul. The test model paint is one of the best ways for you to determine if you're really all in on this project or not. You start with one model, like a character or a solo or something like that, some kind of hero, and you do it to the best of your ability. And that is the major, that's like a big decider on if you're going to stay with it or not.
Yeah, and that has saved me a lot of money in the coming years, because there have been a lot of projects. Like, I think when Slaanesh got their model update, I was like, that looks cool. I just bought Sigvald, painted Sigvald, and said, cool, that scratched the itch. I just saved myself buying a giant army that in reality I was never going to finish or play. So there's been a lot of that in terms of planning my projects. It's just trying to determine whether it's temporary hype or an actual interest. There are other factions like Nighthaunt, where I saw the model line, saw the rules, and I was like, these guys are my ride or die. I don't care if the rules are bad. I'm going to have fun with these. And so, you know, at this point, I think I've got a little over 10,000 points of Nighthaunt. And they've, you know, waxed and waned in terms of play strength, but I just love the model line so much that it's fine. And I've been okay with that. There have been a lot of other factions like Dark Eldar that I bought into just because I thought they aesthetically looked good, but I just didn't care enough for the playstyle to really keep them going. And because the game is such a big part of the hobby, if you don't like playing them, you're not going to paint them because you're not going to have the motivation to get them onto the table. And so you end up with a lot of gray plastic for projects that you thought were going to be fun, but just kind of fell to the wayside.
Yeah, and you guys were talking about those battle boxes, and you have to think twice about getting the starter box or splitting a starter box with a friend or, you know, picking up that combat patrol, whatever it might be, because chances are you're going to look at it and say, oh, that's a good deal. You know, you go through the list of stuff that's in there and you're like, oh, that's a free HQ choice or that's a free Rhino. Man, that's really nice. Then really think, do you need those models, or are you getting them just because they're a good deal? And the good deal will often just sit on your shelf, not painted, because you don't need half the stuff that's in the box. And try to focus on, especially when you're looking at your budget, is there stuff that you can get secondhand? Do you have a buddy who plays a similar army? Can you get some stuff sent your way from a friend just to get that initial starter piece? So I'm at the point now where when I look at my big hobby investments, I'm okay spending less money on the troops and then really forking out money for a big tank or something that's interesting to be a centerpiece for the game. And I used to be absolutely against third party, but so many third party companies make really nice character models. If you're just playing with your buddies, those are really good, really cool looking. You know, it can give your arm a unique flair. Of course, if you're going to run the tournament circuit or play in a store, they might have some rules against that. So be aware. But I think that can sometimes kick your hobby into gear as well, as you've got a unique model that no one else has, and you really want to show that off. So think about the project that's really going to get you excited, and you're going to get a good deal on, and is going to be useful. So I'll look at it from all those different aspects. It'll help you.
Yeah, I remember that was one of the big selling points for Age of Sigmar, was the centerpiece models were so cool. That if you could find that big monster model to paint, it kind of just fell into place that you would build an army around it eventually. One bit of advice that I always hear and have been really bad about following is trying to get a game in before you buy anything. Depending on your local, you know, groups and stuff like that, there is a huge amount of models, painted, unpainted, just sitting around. It's not going to be as difficult as you think to try to just say, hey, does anybody have, you know, a World Eater's army? I want to try them out. Would you mind bringing 1,000 points to the store? Because there's definitely been a lot of stuff I've bought in the past where if I had just gotten a demo game in before I bought anything, I would have saved myself a lot of money. One thing that's really helped me with Heresy is buying the Age of Darkness box and just proxying those tactical marines as other stuff, right? I learned very quickly that veterans were not the way to go for me without having to buy and kitbash veterans. Saved me a lot of money doing that. You know, I got to experiment with different loadouts for Reavers without actually putting any, you know, chain axes on models. And, you know, outside of something a bit more on the competitive side, you can get away with that stuff as long as you're talking with your opponent and making sure that they're okay with you testing things out. And I'm pretty lucky that Brandon's usually pretty okay with just about anything I bring, so long as the base model is close in size. So that'll help you get a much better feel for what you need and what you're looking to play and whether you even like the play style or not. It's just testing it out before you really sink the money.
Yeah, so once you guys are into your project, you have made that decision, got some models. What do you think is harder? Is it the middle section or actually finishing the project? Like, and how do you hit those two pieces of it? We've talked about beginning. How do you crush the middle and then actually finish it?
That's a tough question. I think, I know when I was getting ready for the Ferox event last year, something that really helped me in or helped me to concentrate on finishing a list was actually cementing in a list that I wanted. So when I was hanging out with Brandon that week, I play tested an army for, for that week. And then I painted up, like I got rid of the stuff that wasn't working for me. And I honed in on what I had to have done. Setting yourself some kind of deadline will help you figure out what, because I had to be done by, you know, by the time the event rolled around. Setting yourself a deadline is what will get you to the finish line, because so long as you leave your project open-ended, you won't feel any incentive or reason to concentrate on it and get it done. At least for me, that's how it is for me personally. My big problem with Night Lords right now is that I don't, like when I go down to my local hobby group, I've got most of my stuff primed, you know, that'll be fine because it's just free play, you know, friendly games. If I wanted to get, you know, if I wanted to take them to an event, I would have to buckle down and get it done. Right now, I don't really have much of an incentive to get it done.
Yeah, that's been my biggest problem with almost everything is I don't really have any major events coming up. We're not doing any big gaming groups. It's just been a lot of like me hanging out with Brandon and throwing down a few casual games. So it ends up being like, well, as long as everything's built, you know, all right, yeah, it doesn't look as good without paint, but who cares, right? So finding those kinds of deadlines, even if they're arbitrary, helps a lot. Even just having something like Brandon's been having me paint some of his Khorne stuff because I just wanted a fun project. And he, when he gave them to me, he told me, hey, man, there's no deadline on these. Just whenever you get around to them, just mess with them. And I was like, that was the wrong thing to say because it's been like 4 years now and I've barely touched them. But then what will happen is he'll come to me and he'll just be like, hey, you still have, you know, those Khorne Berserker guys I gave you? Can I have those by the end of next week? And I'll paint 20 of them and just have them done. It's just having those deadlines, even if they're arbitrary, helps a lot. So just, you know, having one of your friends be like, hey, let's play a game. And can you make sure to have this unit painted for this game in a week? It just helps put that fire under you.
I think that's probably like another good thing to psych yourself up. Like if you know next week you're going to go play a game at your local store, hype yourself up and be like, I got to get this unit done by then. And just keep telling yourself, I got to get it done by next week. I got to get it done by next week. Because like I said, I've left my Ultramarines open-ended. Like I could add anything to that. And I haven't worked on anything since I think last October. So that's the problem with my Ultramarines. Now I want to work on my Night Lords. I haven't had time to set up my airbrush in a couple of weeks. So I just need time to do that, and then I can get back to painting them. But try not to leave yourself an open-ended project, because it's just a kind of an excuse to procrastinate a little bit.
Yeah, and once you do have a bit of experience with the game or with the army, if you do put an end on it yourself and say, I'm going to have 3,000 points, I'm going to have 4,000 points, whatever it might be, you can set that as a reasonable goal and then say, okay, I'm going to be done with that. I can always come back to it later. But like with your Ultramarines, if you leave it open, yeah, that's fine. You can always add more stuff in. But I know a lot of guys who will just, they'll build an army for a tournament. They'll play it for a few rounds. And then when they're done, they sell it on and move on to something else. That's okay too. I think we've all been to that place where we really get emotionally invested in an army, or like, this is our baby, we've got to have this forever, and you can't let it go. Or, you know, I've even been in a place with some armies where I don't feel up to the task of painting it good enough, so it just sits there. I'm like, that's ridiculous, just paint it, you know. And you can get the mental piece of it is really something to be aware of.
That's what happened with painting Bobby G for me. I sat down to paint him one weekend. I got the base coats done and I said, I can't do this. And I haven't touched it for like a year and a half now.
Yeah, you can definitely get into your own head about that painting stuff. But it is like Maniple says, you just have to do it. You will surprise yourself when you get to the end of it with how good it'll turn out. Even if it's not perfect, exactly how it'll be in your head, you will feel satisfied for having completed it. So
that was, I was in a Discord a few months ago, and somebody chimed in and asked, you know, does anybody have advice on painting rivets, like for the Mark VI shoulder pads? And nobody said anything for a couple of hours. And finally I got in there and I was like, bad news, brother, you just got to get in there and do it. You can't let those tedious little details stop you from engaging in the hobby. Once you sit down and start doing little dimples on rivets, it goes by in a couple of minutes. It's done. You don't have to worry about it anymore. Don't let that stop you from engaging with the hobby.
Yeah, and I think there's been this sort of trend with YouTube painters where people have kind of forgotten the fact that the tree gets lost in the forest with an army. Not getting those rivets right on those models isn't going to matter when you have 50 guys on the table. But we've gotten so used to seeing these like master painters on YouTube spend, you know, 3 weeks painting one golden demon model. And we all think that that's what our stuff has to look like. But the reality of it is that's not feasible. There's just no way you can paint that many models to that level of paint perfection. So you just got to get that out of your head.
Also, don't let yourself forget that you might be new to this hobby, so don't let yourself get overwhelmed by watching other painters paint, because they might be very quick and very good, but they've also been doing it for 20 years. So don't be the new guy that's like, I'll never be that good. Well, you need to persevere and keep with it, and then maybe someday you'll be that good. But right out of the gate, none of us were. So don't feel bad when you're not either.
Yeah, I remember. It's too bad Brandon's not here because he could talk about it. I remember when I first met Brandon, you know, I'd been playing for a little over a decade and he had just gotten back into the hobby after having, you know, not played for a very long time. And he brought that up where he was like, I just feel really intimidated seeing guys like you and some of the other players coming in with these like amazingly painted models. And I was like, well, here's the thing, dude. I've been painting Marines for, you know, 15 years. Yeah, my stuff's going to look a little better, but that's just, you know, that just comes with time. There's not some secret trick to it. You just have to keep on at it. And, you know, if you look at Brandon's stuff now, he has made massive improvements in his quality. Like, his models look amazing now. And, you know, it's just a matter of time. That's all it takes. So you just have to keep doing it.
And thinning your paints. That helps.
Yeah, two thin coats.
Brandon is so funny because he has gotten so good at painting. Whenever you compliment him, he looks surprised. What do you mean? Are you messing with me? It's funny to see his reaction sometimes because he really sells himself short. And I feel like a lot of hobbyists do the same thing. It's like, don't underestimate how good you've gotten after a few years of practice. So just stick with it, boys.
Well, one more thing I want to bring in here for the starting a new project. Do you guys ever start it because you think of a cool story behind the army, or you like a piece of fluff? And then do you ever write out the history of your particular unit that you're putting together?
Personally, I've never done that. I have seen people that do that. I don't know why. That just never really stuck out to me. The only time I think I've ever really engaged in something like that was with Mordheim, where the game kind of gives you a structure to build characters. But if it's just free form, it's just like, that's squad 3. Cool. And that's about as far as I've always gone with it.
So like back when I was big in 40K, I have massive headcanon for my 40K stuff. I've never written any of it down. And after I got involved with some of the Furyk stuff, I felt more compelled to give my Ultramarines some backstory, for which I still haven't written any of it down. So while I have those thoughts, I'm very bad at putting it on paper. And that's not just with the Warhammer hobby. I'm the same way with like my RPG groups. I've got big headcanon for this big role-playing session that I've been in for like a year and a half now. And I've written down maybe like half a paragraph of backstory for any of my stuff. And I've kind of been drip feeding the DM to, you know, kind of engage with him. And it's kind of a failing on my part, but yes, Maniple, I do have those thoughts and feelings. And that's kind of why I engage in the hobby.
And I think in 30K it can be a little more difficult because it plays more like a historical game than a fantasy game like 40K. In 40K, you can certainly build an entirely new unit from scratch and a new army with a totally different history in any one of the dozens of factions that it has. But in 30K, it really is based on the historical narrative of things that we know, quote unquote, happened. So in order to make a unique character out of it, it might be a little difficult. So you'd have to read the lore, understand where this unit was in between these two battles and say, okay, this represents them at this particular time. Based on the lore, and that's why they have this heraldry, or why they have this these battle honors, or whatever you might have, and this is why this character is leading them. Certainly for other games, I've done a lot of that in the past. I think I remember being on vacation once, I just brought a notebook with me and spent the whole time writing out the history of my Iron Hands units. And I've got that on a shelf somewhere. I've been looking for it now for a few years, but I wish I could find that because I had it all drawn up and I figured out their connection with the local knight household and with their troops and with the local Imperial Guard regiments and all this sort of stuff, so I could make these whole combined army units. That does make the game fun. I don't know if it gets you painting, but for the right person, it might get the motivation going to get started.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and with Heresy, I will note that most people don't seem to engage with it on that level, but they have put in stuff to allow for a bit of flexibility. I remember recently they did something where they put a light on like the Ultramarine 77th Company. And it was, you know, it was the blue paint scheme, but they incorporated a lot of like black accents on the shoulders and like striping on the arms and stuff. And they're like, oh, this is like an unknown like assault company that the Ultramarines deploy. And here's an alternate paint scheme if you want to run this like very unique, strange little offshoot group. And they did that with the World Eaters as well, where they were like, oh, here's a scouring era paint scheme where you get rid of the blue and you supplement it with white and red instead. So there's definitely some ways you can tweak legions to match something that falls more within your paint scheme. But yeah, it does kind of require a little bit more understanding of the lore of the setting. You can't just be like, well, here's my unique chapter that I just made up from the planet, who cares, whatever, and here's my paint scheme. But there is definitely some ways to customize, and especially now that Black Shields and Shattered Legions are out, they're, you know, at that point you've basically taken the gloves off and you can paint them however you want and just say they're Black Shields.
Moving on to our next subject, we are going to talk about some hobby news. And Paul, you have gone over the article concerning the new Light Sentinel, haven't you?
Yeah, I gave it a brief once over. So, you know, we've talked a couple of times about that new Sentinel Walker that Solar Auxilia is getting. And just a little while ago, they posted the rules for free onto the Warhammer community site, so you can get a look at these things. You know, they're just sort of a light weapons platform, fairly mobile with a 10-inch move. They're 50 points apiece. Squadrons come in twos and can go up to six. Yeah, they got a, you know, small selection of weapons, multi-lasers, grenade launchers. There's a different pattern that has Volkite calivers and heavy flamers. You know, it's an interesting thing, and it's cool to see sort of like the precursor to the 40K Sentinel. I don't think they ever had a model for this in 1.0, but off the top of my head, I don't remember. So yeah, just an interesting little thing. It's cool that they're, rather than wait for a book to put this out, they just gave it straight to the players so they can go right to the tabletop and not have to worry about, you know, waiting on rules.
Yeah, I like the, well, I don't know if I like it or not. I'll get your guys' opinion on it. For the pointing of it, you get two for 50 points. You can add in up to four more at 18 points apiece. So there's kind of a tax just to have them on the board itself. So the first two cost you 25, the next four cost you 18. Yeah, does that make sense to you guys?
Most units do that. Justarin are that way. You pay an extra 25 points for the first five.
And that seems like a 30K thing.
Yeah, it's the idea I've seen for it is you're paying those points for their special rules. And then what you're buying after is just the model. So like Justarin, that 25 points covers Furious Charge and stuff like that. And then after that, you're paying 50 points per just an extra model to add to the unit.
One thing that I like the model overall. I think it's neat. I've always kind of thought that there was room in 40K for something like this. Or 30K, sorry. It does get the rule where if it runs, it gets shrouded 5 up. I think that's neat, but it reminded me of this for whatever reason. It seems like some oversight in the rules. But White Scars get a unit called the Golden Keshig, which are guys on jet bikes, the special White Scars jet bikes. And if they run, they also get shrouded on a 5 up, except the Golden Keshig has the heavy keyword. So they can't run.
Yeah, they've had a lot of issues with Shrouded. So that rule is actually just a jet bike specific rule. I think the regular bikes have it too. If you run, you get Shrouded 5 up.
I thought it was specific to this one, but I'll have to go back and check.
Yeah, because I know the Sons of Horus jet bikes, which I just buy the basic ones, they have that rule. It's just tied to I think, the cavalry keyword. So anything with cavalry gets Shrouded for running. I'll have to double check that.
It's just weird that this one specialty unit would have the heavy keyword.
And can't take it. Well, there was also, I think I've talked about this before, but they did an FAQ to fix Shrouded where they said fearless units can't shroud. The idea being that fearless units aren't going to be diving for cover. They're just going to walk straight into fire. The problem is Korax and Magnus both have an inbuilt Shrouded keyword, but because they're Primarchs, they have the fearless rule. So as per that FAQ, suddenly they can't use their own Shrouded keyword because they have the Fearless keyword. They ended up fixing that in a later FAQ to sort of walk it back. But Shrouded has caused a lot of issues for people.
Interesting. But with, what's the move on these things? Like 10, 12, what'd you say it was?
They're move 10.
So at move 10, how often do you think you're going to be running them? Because they've got long range weapons, basically.
Yeah, well, it depends. They also have the heavier version, which is move 8 for 65 points. Let's see, the grenade launchers are only range 18. Multi-lasers, I think, are like 24, 36.
Oh, okay. So they're not as long range as I thought.
Yeah, and then the heavy ones take heavy flamers and Volkite calibers. So these guys are pretty mid to short range. The idea is these are supposed to be a fast flanking unit, so you throw them into somebody's side and just go multi-laser and just try to pick people off.
They're toughness 5.
Yeah, I'd almost want to save them in cover till about round 3, then run in and charge someone off of an objective or try to flame someone off. But if they're going against Space Marines, are those flamers and multi-lasers going to be any good?
Against Space Marines? Probably not.
Yeah. So this is against other guard. Or
I was going to say everything here is AP4. So Marines are just going to be taking their save. This really does feel like a purely anti-human unit.
Yeah.
Even the grenades, even the crack grenades are strength 6 AP 4.
Yeah, I just saw that. That blows my mind.
Yeah, it is the small blast template.
I would think that the crack grenades would at least have like rend on a 6 up or something, or breaching on a 6 up maybe.
But that's kind of been the problem with the non-Astartes units. They don't fit into the game very well because they just sort of sit outside of what the design principle is.
That's a problem that I've been trying to build lists for like some Ultramar Solar Auxilia, something to go with my Ultramarines. And every list that I built so far just turns into a weight of fire list because, like you said, they don't have anything to handle even armor's 3-up save. So, you know, maybe I'll have to talk to Martin about it because I know he plays Militia, which I'm sure have a similar issue.
Yeah.
But other than just taking a ridiculous amount of las guns and battle cannons, what else can you do?
I mean, it's similar to the 40K IG principle. It's, you know, quantity over quality. It's, yes, you are going to take your armor save against all of my shooting, but can you make 63 up saves in one shooting turn? Probably not. And that's just kind of what they're going for here. It's just that 30K in particular, just the armor saves really don't make a difference to Marines, and everything they have cuts through armor, and points wise it doesn't balance out like 40K does. So you can still take way more Marines than you really would to balance out against Auxilia. But yeah, it's an interesting profile. I'm sure we'll see a lot of them just because they are cheap and easy.
Yeah, I hope they work out for the guys that get them. I think they're neat. I think just a little gun on chicken legs and a seat is just cool to me.
Well, I did see they're also bringing out more stuff for Legions Imperialis. Although the rumors are that this game is not being played very much. Still, the models look really awesome, and it's still something that's kind of on my Christmas list. But if it's still around, I would pick up some boxes of it just to have. I think I said before that, you know, Epic is kind of one of those really good games you never played. And I think this one, the rules look very interesting. I love the models. I think it's got everything going for it, but that scale has always been hard. It's always been a niche group of people who want that small scale. But we've got Stormhammers, there's a Malkador squadron, Dracosan transports, Sakaran squadrons, the fast attack squadron with freaking bikes and land speeders and everything. And now they've even got dreadnought drop pods. So like all this stuff I always wanted to have in my, you know, 40K army, I could be running tons of here in Legions Imperialis, but I haven't bought the models.
What do you guys think? I get that. There's no way I'm going to buy one of the termite assault pods. No way. Not buying one from Games Workshop. Not for what they do on the board and not for how much they cost. But for Imperialis, I can see getting a bunch of them because, you know, it'd be neat to have little ones on the tabletop.
It's funny you phrase it that way because that was the reason I bought Titanicus. Is I was like, there is no way I will ever own a Warlord. And then I walked in and saw Titanicus and I was like, I can put down $100 for a Warlord Titan. And there was a lot of jokes at the time of like, well, if I just buy the right base size and put this on it, I can run it in my 40K games. But yeah, that was the big appeal for it. And as for nobody playing it, I remember looking into this in the first couple months of its release. And the big thing everyone talked about was no one really felt like they could play it because they were missing so many options that building lists off of just the starter boxes and the initial releases just wasn't really feasible. But now that they've come out with a lot of the fast attack options and all the heavies are coming out, now you're going to be able to see people running dedicated lists that are much more customizable. So this is all a good thing for Imperialis. I just hope that it wasn't too little too late. Because it does seem like the initial hype for it has cooled down quite a bit.
Yeah, I just wonder if there was a way for their games to be better integrated with each other, that there was actually a rule set for playing Imperialis and playing Titanicus and playing 30K together so that once you were into one game, you could get some value out of another game. So I always felt like with, at least with Mordheim, for instance, even though, I mean, I get that all those models are the same scale, that I could use those character models in my, in a regular Warhammer list at some level. Whereas with, I mean, I'm going to keep saying epic because that's what I want to call it. But when you have a game of that scale, how do you, there needs to be some kind of mechanic that says, if you have these minis in this scale and you play this game, this is how it might affect your 30K game. But there's nothing really in the rules or in there natively in the playset for you to accomplish that. You get what I mean? What I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of the idea of the old Planetary Empire system. Was it's like, okay, you're going to play Battlefleet Gothic, and then that will determine who has orbital support on your ground campaign. You can play Epic, or you can play, you know, Titanicus, and that'll give you bonuses for these games. But it's kind of hard for them to incorporate a lot of those things because that usually requires a pretty large-scale campaign with a stable player base. And a lot of what they plan around is more like you show up to a game store and play a single game against a single opponent. They can't really factor in like, okay, well, then the next time we play, I get this bonus for beating you in Titanicus. Because the reality of it is, you know, that sort of setting doesn't really happen on a more casual play level. Or even on a like competitive level, you know, that's just introducing a lot of complexity into your like narrative or tournament play that, you know, most people would just avoid and just go straight games.
Yeah, Maniple, you brought up a really good point in that I almost pre-ordered Legions Imperialis, the starter box. I almost got into it. When I really sat down and made myself think about it, like Maniple said, I'm not getting 30K value from Legions Imperialis. And if I'm going to spend more money on little plastic men, I'm going to buy more Night Lords. So I bought a second Mark III Battle Force box instead of Legions Imperialis. And that gave me a bunch of more pieces that I needed to finish out my Night Lords. So, you know, can I buy more Titans and Legions Imperialis stuff, or can I, you know, get another 5 Contakars that I want because I think they're cool, or, you know, pump more money into my Ultramarines or buy more tanks for Night Lords, stuff like that. I am so invested in 30K or just Horus Heresy. I'm not really gonna, I don't see the point in investing in Epic. So that's just where I'm at.
Yeah, and I mean, that's just kind of the problem of being longtime gamers, is at some point you have to step back and be like, how many game systems are too many? You know, I have Malifaux, Infinity, Battletech, all the Games Workshop IPs, you know, the list goes on, and like half of them at this point I don't even play anymore. And so, you know, when the next new thing comes out, is it like, well, do I really want to jump into this? It's great for the people that were super into it, but yeah, for a lot of us, it just kind of becomes noise.
That's my thing too. It's like, even if I got into Legions Imperialis, it's going on the back burner for a couple of years.
Yeah, but you know, we all got into Titanicus and all enjoyed it. When we were together, we played a lot of those games. So I think that's going to come up in our next section on your hobby group and how that will influence your purchases and the games you play. So
how much does fear of missing out motivate you guys to play a game? And go ahead and email us, listeners, on like, do you get into a game because you see other people are having fun and you don't want to miss that? Let us know. What about you two?
I was going to say, yeah, getting over that FOMO is definitely tricky. You know, kind of like I mentioned, I think when I first met Brandon, I had just for 40K and fantasy, I think I had about 10 different armies, all roughly 3,000 points or more. And it was just, you know, every time a new model came out, I had to play that faction because it was going to be the cool new thing. You know, oh man, there's a new rules edition. I got to pick it up because, you know, it's just new is always better and I got to have it. And getting back into the hobby, like I said, with like stuff like Night Haunt, I just sat down and I was like, all right, here's the deal. Night Haunt's the ride or die. I am only buying Night Haunt, nothing else. And I just did that. And all of a sudden, I have an apocalypse size army, you know, instead of 6 armies that are not painted and that I don't know the rules and that I don't enjoy playing. I have one massive army that I can take anything I want, that I really like, that's all painted, and that I know the rules like the back of my own hand. It just, it makes a big difference. And you kind of do have to get over that new car smell on an army and just let it go and just say, no, I've already got what I got and I'm okay with that. And a big part of that, kind of like talking with our new projects thing, is just sort of separating out what is, you know, hype versus what is something that you're really deeply motivated by.
Yeah, I fell in pretty hard to a lot of the different Kill Team editions. And the last one I got into a lot had a bunch of different cards. And the cards had like a special stratagem or something unique you could get. And you only got the card if you bought this terrain pack or this starter box or something like that. And I was chasing all those cards. And then when I finally sat down to play a few games with one of my buddies, I realized that most of them were just absolute garbage. And then like some of the unique scenarios I got were stupid. I thought, wait a second. I paid all this money for this? So, you know, the stuff that came in the original battle box was plenty to play a ton of games with. And so I definitely had the fear of missing out. Like these are not going to be available again because GW, for as much stuff as they sell, they tend to underproduce. What was the last big one was the Armageddon box set, where it was like a skirmish set with a rule book that was coming out right before this new Kill Team. And everybody's like, we got to get this book. But fellas, I'll tell you that if you see a game that you really are interested in and want to get, if you have a buddy who's going to play, go ahead and pick up what you need to play the game. However, the chances are much better that that's going to be on a clearance rack in a year. And if you can wait for a year or pick it up on eBay and still have as much fun playing the game, why not wait? You probably got a project on the shelf you need to finish up anyway. So just offering a little bit of caution there. And just think twice about how many times you've seen that hot new product in the dollar bin.
Yeah, another thing, you mentioned the cards and it reminded me of something. Do you guys remember Malign Portents? Yeah. When that came out, I got way into it. I bought the book. I bought the neoprene mat. I bought all the terrain. I bought the cards. I bought the Knight of Shrouds models. You know, and I think we played it maybe twice. I thought it was very cool. Nobody else at the game store wanted to play it. And so it all sat on the shelf. And then 3 months later, the game system updates. And now all of that stuff is just, you know, on my shelf as a coffee table book, basically, because it's from an outdated rule set that nobody uses. So, you know, there's definitely something to be said about weighing the usefulness of something and trying to get a good feel of how much longevity you're going to get out of things that you're buying.
We are going to do a new segment where we are going to be talking about making friends and building a community. And I think Maniple had a pretty good suggestion for the name on this one. So we're going to call it Lorgar's Quest, the quest of friendship. So this is going to be talking about how to kind of foster, nurture, build a new community, a group, and how to stick with it, how to get people involved. And I'm not going to have much to say on this because I took the easy way out here in my local community of I joined the Discord and I go to game day.
No, I think you should talk about that because that is a unique experience, which I've never done. So tell us about the Discord. What is the Discord?
I was hanging out at one of the local hobby shops. And the store owner actually approached me and asked like if I was involved in any of the communities. I was like, I'm more of a Heresy guy. He brought up like 40K Knight or Age of Sigmar Knight. And I was like, that's cool. I'm more of a Heresy guy right now. And he was like, oh, well, that's cool. Some guys are trying to put together a community for that. And I was like, oh, cool. And he asked me if I was in the local Discord. And I was not. I'm not that big on social media. I'm working on that. I'm trying to be better about that. Just the socializing aspect. So he added me to a couple of the local Discords and got me talking to Trevor here in town. And Trevor has put together a pretty cool community of Heresy players. And we only get together once a month, but there are a ton of people there. There's always games going on. Everybody has a lot of different stuff. And it's cool to just see it all coming together. And we've been going for about 6 months now, I want to say. Maybe longer than that. I think we started just before winter. So this might be like month 7 or 8. Anyway, it's been really cool. Like, go, I guess my advice would be, if you're interested in doing this, and I actually, maybe I need to bring Trevor on for this kind of thing, get him to talk about it, because I know he's done other podcasts in the past. But the one of the easiest steps you can take is figuring out if there's like a local community that's already talking on like Facebook or Discord or something like that, and just start asking people, like, do we want to put together a day for this kind of game? And the only issue that we've run into so far, and I think I mentioned this in an episode a while back, is that we've gotten bounced to a different store now, because our group took off so fast that the store we started at didn't have room for us on the night we were going to play. So we had to go to a different store that had room on Sundays, basically. And which is a good problem to have, basically. It's like you've got so many people that the store can't accommodate you, right? So thankfully, we've gotten set up at a really cool location that has a ton of boards and terrain and plenty of room for us. And I think the medium to communicate is just so vital. And Discord and like Gilded's not as good. Let's face it, folks. Gilded is the Discord competitor. They kind of suck compared to Discord, because Discord does Discord stuff very, very well. So having a medium where you guys can talk to one another, figure out what game you're going to play and what day you're going to play it on, and just try to get consistent about it. And Trevor's done a great job of keeping that organized. I'm actually, I think our next game day is like in a couple of weeks. So I'll talk to him about that and see if he wants to come on sometime and kind of talk a little bit about getting us started. But other than that, how do you guys have any advice on, you know, like Paul Maniple, do you have advice on getting started, getting people together, staying consistent, looking for games, stuff like that?
Well, I'm guessing that most of us probably started our game groups initially when we were in high school or college, right? So these are people that you knew well, you know, in maybe in a learning environment. And then for me, I've been gaming now for over almost 30 years. And you kind of understand that some people are better for the hobby and some are not. And I think if I was going to bring anything into it, I would say to understand your personality types in your group. And you're always going to have somebody. So for me, I'm like I always want to be the boss. I want to be the leader. Once the group is assembled, I'm happy to make the spreadsheets, make the schedules, build the scenarios, tell people what games we're going to play and what day and all that stuff. That part I really like, but I'm not social enough to go out and, you know, make new friends. So it's good to have somebody in your group who's the socializer, who will go out and invite. And I know a few guys who are really good at this. They'll be at work or they'll be at the store, anywhere. They'll say, "Hey, you ever heard of 40K? Hey, you ever heard of Lorgar? You ever heard of Sigmar?" You know, just go on and just start talking about things or show pictures of what they're working on. I tend to be a little more shy about what I'm working on because, you know, you're always worried about that person saying that you're a nerd. But the thing is that anyone I've ever shown my hobby to has had nothing but admiration and respect. They'll say, "How do you paint things that are so tiny?" I'm like, "This is not that tiny. This is easy." So having your director, the person who's going to kind of be running things and keep it organized, is good. Also having your socializer is going to be good. But then a lot of people are going to, especially in the hobby space, are going to be a lot more introverted. And some of those people are going to be more like, you might need to cajole them to get them out to say, "Hey, we're going to have a game, so you've got to work with them." And sometimes they're going to be a lot more shy about the hobby. Maybe they don't feel like they're painting good enough, so they need some help in learning how to paint, learning the rules. You know, I've got one buddy who just refuses to ever memorize the rules. He just wants to be told what to do at every turn. Now, it also frustrates him like that, but be prepared that some people are going to be less analytical. They've got that more of a creative mindset, and memorizing and learning rules is going to be hard for them. But then you've got the creative person who is, just going to be focused on the hobby, just on the painting, just on building the terrain pieces. So if you can kind of cover all those bases in your game group, that's going to be good. But also understand that the introverts and the extroverts are going to think differently about how the game ought to go. if you've got somebody who's really brash and pushy and kind of a loudmouth, it's okay to pull them aside and say, hey, you're really kind of being too overbearing on this person. You don't think you're doing it, but you're being threatening. Particularly, you know, I've known some of these guys who are like 6 feet tall with bad breath and a huge belly, and they just get in someone's face because they just like to talk. Not because they're being mean, but that's how they're coming off. So you have to just be aware of those personality types and manage them.
So there's a personality that exists in all hobby circles, not just tabletop, like if you're a sports guy, if you know you're into shooting, whatever. The person in the hobby is called a hammerhead. And that is the kind of person that hammers you into engaging in the hobby the way they engage in it. And it's kind of difficult to know how to deal with a person like this. The unfortunate scenario I think of is back in my hometown when the local hobby store closed, the only person with a facility where the other guys could get together and play was this kind of hammerhead kind of character. And this is the kind of guy who he has all the stuff. He has all the legitimate models. He has all the rules memorized very, very well. So well that it seems like he's manipulating them sometimes, and maybe he is. And he can be, you know, crude, rude, however you want, just kind of hard to be around. And the community put up with this guy for a long time because he was the only one providing a space. Fuck, I don't know where I'm going with this. I guess I just wanted to
complain. How did you deal with that personality? Did you eventually have to walk away from him?
Well, so that's what I did. And, you know, dealing with someone like this can be pretty difficult because I wanted to keep playing the hobby, but eventually I ended up getting a job out of town. And because of that, I stopped going back on the weekends to play the game. Eventually, and I dropped off in the hobby for a long time because I was so burnt out because of this personality. So the worst thing for, you know, while that person might engage in the hobby very well on their end, it can be the kind of personality that drives other people away. And, you know, not just for the time being, but, you know, I left the Warhammer hobby for, I want to say like 6 years. And, you know, I would still buy stuff from time to time, but I wasn't painting anything. And, you know, it just gets really depressing thinking of how much time I missed out on because, you know, this one guy was really hard to deal with. And it's kind of hard for me to talk about now. It just, you know, in the way of, I still don't know how to deal with it. You know, it's just like, I wanted to keep playing with the other guys. I just didn't want to deal with this guy. But, you know, what else do we do? We don't have anywhere else to play. So I think that what I'm getting at is some groups as a whole will put up with a bad actor for a long time because they bring something vital to the table. And you really need to ask yourself, like, is this the case? I think it's something that you need to figure out on a case-by-case basis.
I was going to say, this is something that has been a problem with a lot of these more nerd hobbies for a long time. And it's something that I think in the past probably 10 years or so has started to be more talked about. You certainly see it a lot with, like, D&D, the idea of starting with a session zero, where you sit everybody down and you kind of talk about what the expectations of the campaign for this group are going to be, what people are comfortable with, what people are not comfortable with, what they're looking for in this experience to try to get everybody on the same page. And I've noticed this is something that people have been kind of talking about with 40K, but haven't really fully nailed on yet. But there is definitely that element of just trying to make sure that everyone feels comfortable and safe, that everyone's there for a good time. I've seen it a lot, you know, these hammerhead type of players, as you call them. There's definitely a level of self-correction there. Some people will just need to be confronted about it. You know, a lot of them just aren't aware. Others I've seen will just slowly get cut from a group. You know, it's just if you're going to be an ass, you know, people are just not going to want to play games with you. That's just how it goes sometimes. Your case does seem to be a bit of an outlier, seeing as it was one of those things where everyone was kind of forced to congregate at his location. I almost wonder if that's a product of the olden days. You know, because I definitely remember some areas I lived where it was like, this is the only game store for miles. And, you know, I went in and did not have a good experience. So do I keep going back or do I just not go? But I think nowadays that's going to be less of an issue. I know living here in Dallas, I can drive, you know, 10 miles in any direction and I'll pass by more game stores than, you know, I'll even know exist. Just the other day, Brandon was like, yeah, I went to this new game store and I looked up the address and it was 5 minutes away from where I lived and I didn't even know it was there. You know, there's plenty of places you can play now. And even with things like D&D, you see like Discord groups getting put together. There's even like people playing Warhammer on Tabletop Simulator. You know, so there's like whole communities being built around that. You don't have to settle for a place that you're uncomfortable anymore. There are options, which is nice. It's great to see.
I've also, one of the things that will kill, another thing that will kind of kill a campaign is if you have a player who's kind of a flake, you know, that they'll say they're going to play, they've committed to the, you know, 4, 8, 6 games you're going to play, and then they don't show up for the first one, don't show up for the second one, maybe show up for the third one, but then go out. I've had guys like that I've tried to include in campaigns for, you know, many occasions, but this time around, I'm not even going to bother, because you get set up with the rankings and you think this guy's going to fill in the spot and we'll have enough to play games. But I know enough now to say, I know he's never going to show up. And if he does, he's going to say, oh, I just want to watch because I can't remember the rules or something. So don't try to force a square peg into a round hole. If you've got somebody who really just does not want to play games, but likes kind of being around the hobby, don't force them into it. You know, understand who your people are and just play to their strengths. Now, something that you guys both said about how you needed a place, because what that meant in the early days of 40K was you've got to have a big ass table, a 4x8 sheet of OSB that's painted and textured. You've got to have boxes and boxes of terrain. Now, especially with a game like 40K, they've made the board smaller. You can get neoprene table mats. You can get, you know, terrain that is, you know, from any number of sources that is easily put together and assembled, you know, it can be flat packed up and ready to go, whether it's MDF or cardboard or what have you. So I think the need for like a dedicated gaming space is not as big as it used to, because they've kind of started to push things back to the kitchen table. Now, 30K is kind of the outlier because it assumes you're playing on an actual full 4x6 board, right? And that's the hardest thing for getting a 30K game together if you're following that old model, whereas almost everything else has gone to a much smaller board size. Like, I used to love playing X-Wing because it was just a 3x3. Man, that was great. And you could easily double the size of the board and still be on your kitchen table. So then you might look at, you know, Warwick was talking about difficult personalities. I think it's fair, like you said, Paul, to set out the ground rules for what you expect out of this game group, but then somebody has to enforce it. If somebody is not playing things the right way, if they're being offensive, if they're being mean, if they're not practicing good sportsmanship, you need to tell their ass to leave. And it's okay to do that. We sometimes put up with far too much of the negative behavior and drive out good people from the hobby because they don't want the headache. And even if they do bring something good, it's not worth the destruction it can cause for someone to lose their hobby for years, or, you know, a new sensitive player coming in who's not used to all the trash talk that we grew up with. You know, somebody has to police that. So it's important.
Yeah, and I think people are very conflict averse, but honestly, it can, if handled right, be productive. I remember one campaign where I was getting a little too murder hobo and had the GM pull me aside and just be like, hey, I just want to talk to you about this. Like, what you're doing at the table, I get that you're having a lot of fun. Nobody else at the table is having fun with this. Like, I want you to just step out. We'll write your character out. We'll give you a character death. But like, what you're doing here is just not working for us. And it was a wake-up call for me, because I had come from murder hobo campaigns. Like, that's what all my friends ran. And this was the first time I had tried a different group. And it was this moment of like, oh, I just never realized that what I was doing was making other people unhappy. And having that moment was like, okay, I need to work on this. And, you know, I went back and played with other people from that group, and they're like, hey, just want to let you know, like, we love what you're doing now. You've definitely, you know, figured out how to fit into this group, and we appreciate you taking the effort. And all it took was, I just needed that person to let me know, hey, you need to work on this. So, you know, it's just something to think about.
Yeah, I think definitely, like, knowing your crowd is very important. I don't talk the same shit to my local group that I talk to you guys, because you've been my friends for a while. Like, Brandon and I will say some harrowing shit to one another. I don't talk to other people the way I talk to my best friend. Just something to keep in mind. Just keep in mind that not everyone is going to have your sense of humor.
Yeah, and a lot of that will just come with time and getting comfortable around people. Yeah, I think out of everybody here, I've probably changed my game group the most. Just because when I move, I literally move states. And so it'll just be like, all right, well, these 10 people that I used to hang out with and play games, you know, now live 20 hours away. I got to find new people. Like when I moved here to Dallas, all I did is I just went to the local GW store, walked in, and there's Brandon. And I'm like, hey, man, I'm here to, you know, talk about the game. And six, seven years later, and we're best friends, you know, in the city. You know, it's just that kind of thing. That's all it takes. Sometimes it's just walking in and saying hi. And
so it was ordained by fate, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it was the classic introvert getting adopted by an extrovert sort of
would
situation.
You describe yourself as an extrovert?
No.
Or
Brandon's,
did he adopt
Brandon's
you? Oh, Brandon's
the
extrovert.
Definitely.
Oh, okay.
He is the one who drags me out of my cave to touch grass.
He would not admit to that.
But yeah. But, you know, that sometimes that's all it takes. Just walking in saying hi. And I think we hung out there at that store for probably 3-4 years before moving on to the next place and the next place. And, you know, met a lot of people here in Dallas to play the game. You know, most have been good. There have been a few outliers where we walk away and we go, what was that guy's deal? But, you know, it's just kind of how it is.
How important is it for you guys that the people in the group really take the hobby seriously, whatever it is? Because, you know, I can think of a couple different scenarios. So you've got you're playing a casual game, but you got the guy who comes in with a very militaristic, competitive style because he wants to do good on the tournament scene. Can that person find a place in that chill, in the kind of that chill game group? Or what about the person who's made up their own bizarre fluff and history for their particular group of Space Marines, you know, that is not found anywhere else in the canon and it's all made up and none of it makes any sense and in fact goes against it? Would that person still find a place there? Are you able to keep their head canon separate from yours enough where they can still play, or do you just rather not deal with it?
Gosh, that's a tough one, because I'm not sure that we were going to get into this, but I think the whole, like, personal head canon is really making its way into the hobby.
What if their whole Space Marine army are furries? Space Wolves? Something along those lines?
I would just be weirded out for me. That would just be too weird for me. I'm not sure that I would... I don't know. I've not run into that. I can't tell you how I would react. I would see that and think, well, that's weird. I'm going to go play a different person for now. You have fun, though.
I mean, that's always been... I remember back 10, 12 years ago, the meme was Hello Kitty Marines. You know, these, like, neon pink Marines with Hello Kitty shoulder pad markings. And it was just like, hey, you do you, you know? All right, sure. Weird chapter from some far-flung part of the galaxy. Honestly, as long as they can show up to the table and not be an ass, like, who cares? It's just part of the game. I think there is this weird holdover in a lot of games that kind of has its roots in historicals, where it's this, we have to be serious about this. Me and Brandon have talked about it. There's this whole thing with some historical groups where it's like, because this is history, it has to be taken seriously, you know, it's the French didn't wear that color of pants in this campaign. You know, we are playing late Napoleonics. They have to be wearing cream colored pants or whatever it is. That can definitely be pretty jarring for a lot of people. And so, again, it's kind of going back to that session zero thing. It's just about finding people that you gel with and that you know are going to be in line with what you're trying to do. And there's not really any reason to force yourself to play. Like I said, there's so many options available to you to seek games and find players that you don't have to force yourself into that, well, this is the one guy's house we can all hang out with scenario anymore.
Right. And my thing is, like, I don't do any of my hobby in the, like, Hello Kitty Marine sense. Mine is all, you know, in-universe stuff. And, you know, because that's why I got into the hobby. I want that verisimilitude. I want to feel like I'm there in a way. Not that, you know, my own, you know, I don't paint Christian Crusader Marines. You know, even though that's a part of history I think is really cool, that's not something I'm going to put on the Warhammer tabletop. You know, I'm not going to bring my own ideology or whatever into Horus Heresy. So, you know, that's why I do Ultramarines and Night Lords, because I want to be, you know, Space Legions or Space Batman. That's what I do. I'm not trying to bring my own thing or, you know, my own values, for lack of a better term, into the tabletop. You know, I'm there for the escapism. I'm not there for the real worldisms.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we're kind of at the point where really whatever they come in, as long as they're painted, we should be like, holy crap, you painted an entire army. That's amazing. Here's my gray plastic.
Yeah, so I think we're in agreement that if somebody comes in and they're kind of a little bit quirky, that's fine. But if they're an asshole, you can ask them to leave. Is that about as far as we'd say we would take any gatekeeping with our hobbies?
I mean, I'm not going to go out of my, like, if I'm not playing that person, I'm not going to go out of my way. I'm not going to go to somebody else's table and interrupt their game and be like, hey, I don't want you here. You know, that's not, I'm not a store owner. I'm not a group. I don't run the group. So I'm not going to be doing that kind of thing. And if I sit down on a table and they start, you know, pulling out some really weird stuff, like just some really disgusting models, I'm just not going to play that person. You know, I don't have to engage with them on the other end of the table. I can just pick up my stuff and leave as well.
I was going to say, if we're keeping people out because of quirkiness, I don't think any of us would have a place to play. That's kind of a prerequisite to being into these types of hobbies, being a little off. The way I've seen it, especially when it's handled on like a store level, is, you know, it just comes down to, are you disrupting the enjoyment of other people in the store, right? It was kind of one of those things, like I remember there was one store that I went to that had a sign that said, if you haven't showered today, please go home and shower before coming in, right? Because that was just, you know, that was just kind of an issue that you dealt with in the 90s with nerds. And it was one of those things where it's like, hey, those people are great and you can have a good time, but sometimes you just have to give them the nudge. And you can have people that are a little, you know, off-putting or a little, you know, rough around the edges. But as long as they can, you know, sit down and have civil conversation with people, then it's not an issue.
Yeah, the BO thing is not nearly as bad as it used to be. I'd even forgotten it was a thing. And yeah. I was at a game store with our older brother, and there was just this weird smell in the air. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And finally, I turned and asked my older brother, what is that smell? And he points to this other guy and says, that guy didn't shower today. That's what it is. I'm like, oh, I forgot that's what that smelled like. So it does still happen. It's kind of unique and, you know, quaint, yeah, when you see it.
Paul, I think you brought up something really important there. And it's like, I think the core of what we're getting at here is, don't be disrupting the hobby for somebody else. And that can go a lot of ways. It's like, don't be coming into the local game store wanting to argue about who the real good guy is. It doesn't matter. We're there to play with little plastic men. You know, and don't be the hammerhead kind of guy that's like, I'm not going to stop talking about this until you agree with me. It's one of the worst things you can do. It's like it's okay that you have your opinion. You don't have to keep arguing with people about, you don't have to keep arguing with people until you feel like you've made your point. Just yeah, let it go.
And it's also, again, it's just be mindful of how you are presenting yourself to others. You know, that's been something that, like I said, kind of like with that whole murder hobo thing, it was just having that pointed out to me and sort of looking at what I was doing and trying to self-correct. And, you know, hopefully, at least I'd like to think that when I go and interact with others, especially in the hobby space, I'm at least putting in the effort to come off as, you know, welcoming and encouraging and helpful.
Yeah, and I think the title for this, Lorgar's Quest, is fitting in more than one way, because Lorgar was never content just to play the game. He wanted to be appreciated. He wanted to be liked. He wanted to, you know, find the secret truths, and he did anything, even betraying his friends, to get there. There is no perfect game of 40K. There is no perfect game of 30K. There is, you know, if he should have focused on what this game is all about, it's fighting awesome wars against your buddies and just being present in the moment, not looking for being right or not looking for winning all the time, but it's, you know, the whole ethos around this is it's just about the war, fellas, just play the war. And if you do that, you're not going to go too far wrong. But if you go down these other tracks of, you know, like Lorgar did, of chasing out the secret truths and being right, you're going to just sell your soul to chaos and ruin the game for everybody else.
And that's when you get the good stuff. I mean, yeah, it's definitely interesting. I don't know. Have you guys played at a lot of different stores or with different groups, or have you stuck mostly with the same people?
As far as 30K grows, 30K goes, I've stuck with the same group, pretty consistent group so far. Back when I was like in high school, kind of just out of high school for a couple of years, that group was pretty consistent back in my hometown as well. And it didn't really start to fall apart, like I said, until we got into this really awful situation of not really having anywhere to be or to play, and then having to put up with somebody with a really poor reputation. So, and like I said, I dropped off for a number of years and didn't engage in the hobby at all. So basically for the most part, I've engaged with the same groups.
As far as like for miniature gaming, it's usually been the same few players, but I've played with lots of different people for role-playing and board games and magic and, you know, other hobbies. So it all kind of depends on, you know, where I'm at and what's hot locally. That's typically what I'll follow. The miniature wargaming has always been there, but the other things have come and gone. But it's interesting how in every group, you continue to see the same kind of personalities, and you'll learn what can derail the group once you've done that a few times. So just get out there, meet some people.
Yeah, for sure. I've definitely... Well, like I said, because I've moved so much and such far distances, I almost have to re-up my gaming group. It felt like almost every 3 to 4 years. And it was like, you know, in Idaho, it was Warhammer. In Utah, it was Magic the Gathering that was big. You know, in Arizona, for some reason, I fell in with Yu-Gi-Oh players. You know, it's just kind of one of those
you're
things.
You're a card player?
Oh, yeah. My start was the Pokemon card game in fifth grade, and I never looked back. I still
that was also Warwick's start, so don't let him make that face at you.
Oh, yeah, I still have the discontinued Legend of the Five Rings trading card game somewhere in here. Thousands of cards. I have the Warhammer TCG. I got all of it.
I've got that terrible War Machine and Hordes card game.
Oh, I forgot about
Manifold,
that.
You might have that. I don't know if I have that here.
Yeah, it's at my house. You need to pick it up next time you come here. I don't know what to do with it.
I'll think about it.
There was a, Paul, did you ever play Blood War? It was the D&D card game based in the Planescape universe.
Oh, yeah. I might even still have those cards somewhere.
I got two starter decks. I need to get some on eBay because the art, I love the artwork on those cards.
That Pathfinder, like, deck building game.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it. Like, you and our older brother and I played in it. And that was awesome. That was so cool.
That was a great system.
Yeah, I would play more of that.
So yeah. Yeah, there's always something. You just got to find people. Well, I think we've beat this dead horse pretty effectively here.
I'm not sure how many legitimate points we made. I feel like we touched on a lot of different stuff, and I'm sure a lot of it will be taken out of context. Because how the internet works.
Brandon's not here to keep us on track, so it's going to be all nonsense. It's part of the fun.
Nobody here but herd the cats. So right. With that being said, let's get into our last segment. That might be a quick one. Kind of an interesting point that one of our viewers brought up. So we're going to get into a Voxcast here, and we've got an email from a new listener. We have an email from a new listener. Hello, Legion Cast. Hope you're all doing well. My name is Nick from Arizona. I'm a relatively new listener of the show, although I've been able to pound my way through your backlog of episodes of the last couple of months. Well, several of my other favorite Heresy podcasts were on slight hiatus. Oh, so we're second fiddle. I see how it is.
As it should be.
I know you're all busy men, so I'll get right to the meat of why I'm sending this message. I've played Warhammer for about 16 years, and I've been a fan of the Horus Heresy novels since I was a teenager. One of my favorite things in the Heresy novels and the 40K genre as a whole is when they make historical references to what is to them an ancient time, often making references to current events or even events that are seen in history to us in the modern context. I wanted to address one such reference that crops up in Angel Exterminatus. And this is pretty interesting. And Maniple, I know you've brought up a similar point with the Fulgrim book. When Kroker is having his mental flashback to his past lives, one flashback which you mentioned is him fighting at the Battle of Verdun, when he is wounded by our friend Alanus Pius. In this flashback, Kroker mentions that in his past life he was a German soldier named Karl. Karl is, as you noted on the episode, cannibalizing other soldiers who had the misfortune of being a little too close to Karl. This scene piqued my interest, as quite often Black Library authors will leave Easter eggs either to historical events or other pieces of literature as such tidbits. After doing a little bit of digging, I learned that during this time in Germany, there was a serial killer and cannibal named Karl Dank. Nice. I wouldn't get into the various crimes he committed, as I know that's not what your podcast is about. If you want to do some research, information on him is pretty easy to find. I will say that he was active from the years 1903 to 1924, when he was apprehended. And now, as far as I found out, there's no evidence that Dank ever served in the war or was anywhere near Verdun at the time of the battle, but I haven't taken a very deep dive, so maybe I'm just missing it. Who knows? Maybe he zipped into France for a bite to eat and stayed for the veritable feast that was Verdun. Oh, that is so morbid. It's also possible that Graham McNeil's disinterest in continuity, expands as far as our own history. I get that now. So Graham McNeil is not the most consistent writer, so he's not interested in historical accuracy either. That's a good point, Nicholas. I really appreciate that as a avid Graham McNeil hater. You never know. And maybe it's just another German cannibal named Karl with no connection to any actual historical figure. Anyways, I hope this didn't put anyone to sleep. I just always find these historical references interesting. Keep up the good work, and I can't wait to hear back from you if you're able. Even if you don't mention this email in your show, I'll keep listening. Best wishes, Nick. Well, thanks for the email, Nick, and we really appreciate those references too. Maniple, go ahead.
Yeah, so Karl looks as though he was a well-known serial killer, and the thing is that, and this is something where Americans will struggle with some of the Black Library writers, is that there'll be some things that they know well as part of their history from either the British Isles or from the continent that never made it here. You know, that we will have grown up learning legends about Geronimo and Sitting Bull and Custer and George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and a lot of people from our history, but we don't get the European side. So someone like Karl Denke might be well known. I just did a little bit of looking at him. And it would make sense that an author would take this well-known cannibal that was kind of active around the same time as these wars, but it looks like they never quite synced up. And it looked like he was using this as a way to make money, because he actually would pickle some of his victims and then sell it as meat, quote unquote, in local shops. So
yeah, he like sounds a Sweeney Todd kind of thing.
Kind of a Sweeney Todd scenario. But he was, captured by the police. I think they knew what was going on. But yeah, he apparently had quite 30 to 40 victims, possibly more. So yeah, that sounds like a connection a Black Library writer would make. And we'd love to hear those historical connections like that. It brings some life to the story.
Yeah. Well, and the nice thing about a lot of those references is, even if you don't pull that Karl reference out, it doesn't take away from the story at all.
Right.
Honestly, just pulling the fact that he's like some dude in Verdun is enough. I do also like to note that a lot of the more on-the-nose references they make, they get wrong in the books on purpose. Like, they attribute a quote to Shakespeare, the great playwright, you know, from like N2 or whatever.
I like, Maniple, you did the research during the Fulgrim where there's the old story about, I can't remember his name, but he's got the silver hands and he gets his head cut off. And we get that set up at the beginning of Fulgrim, and then by the end, when Ferris Manus has his head cut off, it all kind of comes together. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that. One that I got recently that I was very happy I picked out is in the new Beckwin novels. There's a part where she goes into a curio shop and she picks up this model rocket and she's looking at it and she can't figure out what it is. And the guy's like, oh, that thing's ancient. It's from like, you know, way back in Terran history. And she like rotates it over and it says CCCP on the side. And it's an old Russian rocket model. I was like, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I remember that. That was really funny. Yeah. I know Dan Abnett will do some as well. Like when he introduces like some of these army units, like the Winged Hussars were basically reconstituted during the Unification Wars. And so they have these like cybernetic horses that they rode around, and there was the whole Tupelo Lances and everything like that. I think that's pretty neat. I remember Brandon just doesn't like Prospero Burns, but you know, Caspar Ansbar Hauser, like Maniple brought up in that episode as well. It might be like more of a European style story, so we in America wouldn't get it, but even like the couple of lines that we get of that being a real world story is pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, well, and especially with the Guard, it seems Solar Auxilia and 40K Guard are where they get to put in a lot of that stuff, just because of the way they can destroy it or describe the uniforms and the unit compositions, you know, stuff like the Geno 2 fight Chilliad and the Vestroians and stuff. They all have very real world analog sort of comparisons that you can make that you can't really do with Astartes as easily, just because of the way Astartes are written. So it's cool to see that stuff.
Yeah, remember when you're reading these books that no author puts stuff in the book by accident. You know, they're gonna, if they include a name, it's significant. If they include a place, it's significant. Even I'm sure that the choice for him to put CCP on the rocket instead of USA is significant. You know, it shows something about the theme the author's trying to get through at that moment. And that's what a good writer will do.
Yeah, which that's another thing. We've talked about the references to Shakespeare or Shakespeare correctly. You know, all of the like founding Legion homeworlds are named after, you know, Shakespearean names. And there's just a bunch of stuff like that, you know, Prospero being one that comes to mind immediately. But yeah, there's just a lot of little hidden goodies in there for anybody that really digs into history, which does seem to be a cross section for tabletop gaming. Again, because a lot of it comes and derives from historicals. So you just find a lot of people that are interested in that stuff kind of gravitating to these things. Cool email. Thank you for writing in. It was Nick, right?
Yes.
Always good to hear from everybody. Should we wrap this up? Yeah, well, you know, we had a good one here today. Brandon's not here, so I will say to march in fortune.
Have a good one, Longbeards. Stay safe.
Well, if you listen this long, folks, thank you very much for sticking around. Why don't you go ahead and look us up on social media? We are LegionCast, a Horus Heresy podcast on Twitter. And shoot us an email at legioncast18@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you folks. Don't forget to leave us a comment and a rating. Share this podcast out to all your buddies. Share it with your game group and let us know how we did in our starting a game group or fostering the community kind of segment. We're looking forward to hearing back from you. Until next time, folks.